reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports on talks between the White House and House Speaker Mike Johnson on Israel and Ukraine aid.
House Speaker Mike Johnson is negotiating with the White House as he prepares to advance wartime funding for Ukraine and Israel despite Republican division. House Republican leader Steve Scalise told reporters that Johnson had been talking with White House officials about a package that would deviate from the Senate's $95 billion foreign and include several Republican demands. Johnson has delayed for months advancing aid that would provide desperately needed ammunition and weaponry for Kyiv. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Georgia Republican, has threatened to try to oust Johnson as Speaker and warned that advancing funding for Ukraine would help build her case that GOP lawmakers should select a new Speaker. Norman Hall, Washington.
Israel's military announced Thursday what it called a new improved measure to bring humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip, including constructing a new land crossing in northern Gaza. VOA's Jeff Custer reports.
International humanitarian groups have complained for months about barriers in bringing aid by truck into Gaza, citing both delays by the Israeli military and a lack of safe access to areas such as northern Gaza. In a video statement, military spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Haggerty said the new crossing would enable 58 more trucks per day to pass through from the seaport of Ashdod through the new crossing and into Gaza.
The combination of these new measures means that we expect the daily average of trucks going into Gaza to go up gradually from 350 per day to around 500 per day.
Jeff Custer, VOA News.
U.S. President Joe Biden says the defense commitment to Pacific allies is ironclad after meeting with Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Thursday. This is VOA News. Mexico wants the U.N. to suspend Ecuador over its police raid on the Mexican embassy. VOA's Alexis Strope tells us more.
Mexico's President Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador says his country is demanding that the United Nations expel Ecuador from the world body as part of a complaint to the top UN court over Ecuador's police raid last week on the Mexican embassy in Quito. Tensions between Mexico and Ecuador have soared since late last week when the Ecuadorian authorities forced their way into the diplomatic mission to arrest Ecuador's former vice president, Jorge Glass, who had been holed up there seeking asylum in Mexico. I'm Alexis Strope, VOA News.
AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports the U.S. House is going to have to go another Friday and reauthorizing a spy program the FBI says is crucial to stopping terrorism.
House Speaker Mike Johnson is expected to bring forward new legislation to reform and extend part of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as Section 702. It's a tool FBI Director Christopher Wray calls
indispensable in keeping Americans safe from a whole barrage of fast-moving foreign threats.
However, a conservative revolt prevented an earlier bill reauthorizing it from reaching the floor. Johnson's Plan B would extend the program for 2 years instead of the full five-year reauthorization first proposed. Johnson hopes that'll be enough to sway GOP critics. Ben Thomas, Washington.
In a deepening crackdown, Mali's ruling junta on Thursday banned the media from reporting on activities of political parties and associations a day after suspending all political activities in the country until further notice. The order issued by Mali's High Authority for Communication was distributed on social media. Notice said it applied to all forms of the media, including television, radio, online, and print newspapers. The Italian Coast Guard says it rescued 22 people and recovered 9 bodies after a smuggler's boat capsized in a storm about 30 miles south of the island of Lampedusa. Survivors indicated that the steel-bottom boat had departed from Tunisia overnight Sunday, carrying 46 people from Guinea, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Ivory Coast. The UN Refugee Agency says the boat capsized Wednesday morning as waves reached up to 16 feet. The victims include a 6-month-old child. You'll find more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, April 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Calls grow for justice and accountability as Sudan marks 1 year of conflict.
Justice is really important to be dealt with now because Sudanese people have been waiting not only through this war, but as well atrocities have been committed for years in Sudan, and that is something really supposed someone to be held accountable.
Striking Kenyan doctors reject another government ultimatum to end a month-long strike for better pay. A U.S.-based professor of applied economics calls for the disbandment of Zimbabwe's Reserve Bank. A judge in Liberia jails a local chief for allegedly forcing three young women to undergo female genital mutilation.
In this case, I think women should have freedom to decide what they want to do. Every girl has the right to decide whether to go in the bush or not. They shouldn't be forcefully adopted.
An environmentalist called on Shell Oil to clean up vast polluter areas in Nigeria's Niger Delta. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. This week marks 1 year of instability in Sudan, and efforts to address violations of rights abuses are proven to be a challenge. Munem Adam is an influential lawyer who supported the International Criminal Court in The Hague in the case against the Sudan government. He is also the director of the nonprofit Access to Justice Program. Adam tells viewers John Tanza that no matter how long it takes, individuals who committed crimes during Sudan's current conflict will be held accountable.
Justice is really important to be dealt with now because Sudanese people have been waiting not only through this war, but as well atrocities have been committed for years in Sudan, and that is something really supposed someone to be held accountable. And I think as well perpetrators in Sudan, they are as well committing more crimes because they find ways for impunity is really easy. And this atrocity now, both sides and the allied militias, they really committed horrific human rights violations. And I think somebody's supposed to be really kind of go and they pay for the crimes that they committed. And I think that's really important to be dealt with as soon as possible.
Munem, it's easily said perpetrators could be held accountable. But this conflict in Sudan between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, one would say it's going to be difficult to pinpoint. At the end of the day, accountability boils down to holding people who have committed crime accountable. How possible is that going to happen in post-conflict Sudan?
I agree with you to some extent. Accountability is not easy by itself, generally. The perpetrators in Sudan really like organizations and activists and professionals be paying very close attention to the data being collected and analyzed, because in order to be able to pinpoint as well and to mention who's like really kind of to be the accused person, you're supposed to have as like solid data and as well with dealt with like in a very kind of like high analytical way. And that is really like now in the process. But you mentioned the war as well is taking place in the urban area. We have the chain of command. In most cases, very clearly, we have as well a spokesperson that they speak for both sides. And as well, we have people that witnesses in different places. They really spoke openly about these crimes. And as well, there are a lot of testimonies have been collected about who really committed crimes. However, there is like as well the public where we see like both parties and as well the allied militias, they really kind of all the time throwing some information about themselves from both sides. And I think that even can really be used in the future.
That's influential lawyer Munay Adams speaking with viewers John Tanza. Striking Kenyan doctors have rejected another government ultimatum to end a month-long strike for better pay and improved working conditions. The doctors also got a boost on Thursday from opposition leader Raila Odinga, who appealed to the government to reinstate the 206,000 Kenyan shillings, or about $1,590, for interim doctors until the next negotiations. The latest government ultimatum came from the head of public service, Phyllis Kuske. He urged the doctors to return to the negotiating table in compliance with a court order or face disciplinary action. Dr. Simon Chigondu is a president of the Kenya Medical Association. He tells me the doctors are concerned that even if they call off their strike, the government may still not come to the negotiating table.
When the court case came up, the government had filed a contempt, so to speak, claiming that the doctors had not called off their strike. But this was based on the fact that the government had failed to turn up for negotiations. So the court advised that both the doctors and the government sit and agree and then file a report in 14 days' time. And the court threw out both contempt cases because the doctors also filed a counter-contempt saying that the government had failed to come to the table. The government claims that the doctors should call off the strike before they come to the table, and the doctors claim that you can't call off a strike when there is nothing on the table. So that's the point at which we are. Even if you called off the strike, the doctors may still not come to the table.
But according to the article I'm reading, the government is promising to reconvene what they call the Whole Nation Approach Committee 24 hours after you call off your strike. What exactly is this committee supposed to do?
Yeah, so there was actually a meeting. Felix Koske is the head of public service. Had been appointed by the president to lead this negotiation after the previous industrial action had taken for long. So one meeting was had, then a subcommittee was formed to discuss that, and that is the committee that failed to appear in the last time before they went to court. So the preconditions that the government is having now, that the strike be called off, is not acceptable to the doctors because they fear that once they call off the strike, the government will still not come to the table.
Dr. Simon Chigondu is the president of the Kenya Medical Association. Government officials were not immediately available for comment. A U.S.-based professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University, Steve Hanke, is calling for the disbandment of the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe, saying it has failed to stabilize the country's currency. Last week, Harare launched a new currency, the Zimbabwe Gold, or ZiG, the sixth attempt in the last decade to de-dollarize. Hanke maintains that the new currency is dead on arrival.
I think it's another joke. That's my take. It's going to fail like all the other schemes that the government has come up with. And one reason for that is that no one really has any trust in the government. If you're issuing a currency, you have to have some trust. I'm not saying a lot, but you have to have some trust. I think the level of trust in Zimbabwe, the government's almost zero.
How about their assurance that this currency will be backed by gold?
Number one, that's also the currency is a joke, and that promise is a joke, too. Zimbabwe suffers from something called anomy, and that is no matter what the law is or the rules, they aren't followed. No one follows the law. So the law behind the ZiG says that it's backed by gold, but no one will follow that law. And one reason they won't follow it is that they don't have the gold to back it up. Where's the gold?
Well, they showed their vault and then said there's somewhere in the world. They did not mention where. And they also said they have a reserve of about 100 million, making it 300 million. How much really is needed to have a stable currency in a country like Zimbabwe?
It's really impossible to know because it depends on how many units of the ZiG that they issue. If they issued zero ZiG, they'd have to have zero gold backing. You see what I mean? It's a function of how many units of the currency they're issuing. The only hope for Zimbabwe is to fully dollarize and get rid of the central bank. They have to really get rid of the central bank completely.
U.S.-based professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University, Steve Hank. He was speaking from Washington, D.C. with VOA Zimbabwe service reporter Blessing Zulu. Blessing also spoke with Persistent Wanyaya, an advisor to the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe.
What he thinks and what he wishes and hopes for. But I think as a country, as Zimbabwe, we should do what we think is good for ourselves, which I think is what we have done, to try and improve from the previous current regime and better our currency with gold and the precious mineral reserve. I know Professor Anke would always wanted us to adopt a current body or to dollarize, and which we didn't do. So I'm not very sure if the reaction is in response to what he was expecting and which we didn't do.
Mr. Hanke is actually saying that he has revised his view on the need for a current board in Zimbabwe because of what he is alleging to be failure to respect the laws. He's just saying Zimbabwe simply needs to dollarize. They don't even need the currency, the currency board.
We dollarized before, where are we? So how does it become a solution, an effective solution, when we did that before and we know where we are today. Dollarization, in my view, as always said this, is never a permanent solution to the current crisis.
Persistent Gwanyaya is an advisor to the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe. He was speaking from Harare with VOA Zimbabwe service reporter Pleasant Zulu. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 12. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. A judge in Liberia has jailed a local chief, Zoe Nora Samuel, since Tuesday for failing to produce three young women who were allegedly taken by force, detained, and likely initiated into the Sandy Society to undergo female genital mutilation, or FGM. Liberia does not have a legal mechanism for banning female circumcision, although the National Council of Chiefs last year outlawed the practice. Mobedo Nadine Joa is the attorney representing the Organization for Women and Children and Community Health Care Initiative. He filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus for a judge to compel Chief Zoe Nora Samuel to produce the three young women. She tells me that the Liberian women should have the freedom to decide whether they want to undergo FGM or not. They should not be abducted.
According to our laws, the writ of habeas corpus is called the great writ for a reason. Anyone can file that writ of habeas corpus, and any judge of the circuit court or of the higher court can sign and order the habeas corpus. So in this case, this missing girl, Rachel Dunn, was a staff of Community Healthcare Initiative. So we filed for her release, because we felt that her rights were restrained in contravention of Article 21 and Article 20 of the Constitution of Liberia. So we filed a writ of habeas corpus to have her released because she was restrained by the traditional council in the zones of the town, which is under the Ministry of Internal Affairs. This is why the Ministry of Justice have to represent her. It is not because we do not have the capacity. We do have the capacity. And the judge also reiterated that in his ruling.
Is it a violation of any Liberian law, the fact that these young ladies have gone to the Sandy Bush? Is that a law there in Liberia that prohibits this?
There's not a law that prohibits female genital mutilation. But the young ladies were abducted. They were taken against their will. They did not want to go. In fact, they called us. They said they had been forcefully abducted. And even they had Zoe testified in court that she had been initiated. This is why the writ was issued, because it is issued when somebody is restrained against his or her will in violation of the Constitution of Liberia.
What would you like to see happen to the Zoe?
Not to the Zoe in particular. I wouldn't want anybody's rights to be violated. In this case, I think women should have freedom of choice, freedom to decide what they want to do. Every girl has the right to decide whether to go in the bush or not. They shouldn't be forcefully abducted. I think justice It's a threat that binds every society together, and I think the rule of law should be followed.
Attorney Mobedo Nadine Joa is the attorney representing the Organization for Women and Children and Community Health Care Initiative of Liberia. She spoke with us from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Counselor Swaliho Cisse represents the Liberian Ministries of Justice and Internal Affairs. He tells me that the Organization for Women and Children and Community Health Care Initiative does not have standing to file a petition for a writ of habeas corpus for a judge to compel Chief Zoe Nora Samuel to produce the three young women.
She has been incarcerated because the order that was given by the court to her and it produced the living body, because the writ of habeas corpus is one of the powerful writs in our jurisdiction here in the world over. So it's usually not delay if you delay, you know, the court mandate that you produce the person and your failure is contemptuous. And so they were held in contempt because when we were served the documentation to make the representation on their behalf, we didn't have no idea what had happened, but the application itself, it was faulty because the petition was filed by an organization, a women organization, and it fell short of naming the children or the person they sought the court to order the souls to produce, that they were possibly arrested and initiated. Because of that, we had to now ask for time so we can be able to talk to them and get an adequate identification of who they sought to have the court order to be produced.
Counselor, according to the article, one of the individuals wanted to be produced by this Chief Zoe is a 22-year-old who is an adult, and that they were forcefully taken to the Sandy Bush by the defendants against their will. And you are saying that they do not have standing on this?
Because when you make an application and you file a petition before the courts, the application for the writ must be particular, material, and specific. And that application fell short of that. Yes, though the person they sought to represent is 22 years old, and that the parents were even saying to us that, look, these guys do not represent us. We don't know how they got it. Yes, but the person would have been taken against their will, and this organization have the right to come and represent them, maybe by seeking their consent. But if their families are coming out to say no, it makes it difficult for, because we, as the Ministry of Justice, are also interested in ensuring that the appropriate things are done, and people should not be here against their will.
Counselor Swaliho Cisse represents the Liberian Ministries of Justice and Internal Affairs. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. Environmentalists say the people of Nigeria's oil-rich delta are running out of patience over their demand for Anglo-Dutch oil giant Shell to clean up vast polluted areas before leaving the country. Nimo Bassi is the director of the ecological think tank, the Mother Earth Foundation. He told viewers Jinudi Ofor that conditions have worsened as more spills have been recorded.
There is actually no cleanup at all. So communities are stuck, they're worried, there's a lot of anxiety, and there's no indication about any plans to audit the environment, audit the health situation of the people, or to carry out any cleanup.
Has the Nigerian government officially signed off on Shell exiting that area and also approving someone else to take over, a group of people to take over?
The whole series of divestments and selling off by international oil companies has been going on for some years now, but there is no clarity about when any of this is concluded. But the last we heard in the public was Shell submit their documentation to the Ministry of Petroleum Resources, they're going to be approved, which also got us worried because whatever documentation is submitted ought to be based on very clear principles. Right now, we don't have a clear policy on divestment. And even if a company is going to wind down operations on a particular oil well, there's always expectation that they should make good that land, that territory, to what it was before they began to exploit oil there. So right now, what we've heard from the media, what is in the public domain, is that there's a Nigerian entity which is promoted by Shell itself and buying the assets from Shell itself. So it does look like Shell will be operating in the shadows under a different name without really being visible or ready to take responsibilities for all the harm that have been done to the environment and to the people.
What are the conditions of the Niger Delta at the moment? Shell says it is working to improve the situation.
The conditions are worse than they've ever been because every single day when a polluted environment is not cleaned up, the pollution gets more deep-seated and even more complex.
That's Nimo Bassi, the director of the ecological think tank, the Mother Earth Foundation. He spoke from Benin City with the U.S. Chinedu Ofor. It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the CAF Futsal Africa Cup, which got on the way on Thursday in Morocco. Zambia made their return to the CAF Futsal Africa Cup with a commanding 5-2 victory over Ghana in the opening fixture of the 7th edition of the competition in Rabat. Host Atlas Lions of Morocco kicked off their Futsal AFCON 2024 campaign after the Zambia-Ghana match with a comprehensive 5-2 victory over Angola at the Prince Mole Abdullah Hall. The 5th edition of the Kipkino Classic World Continental Tour is set for a thrilling showdown between Olympics and World Athletics medalists at the Nyayo National Stadium in Kenya on the 20th of April. This year's edition has attracted Olympics 200-meter silver medalist Kenneth Bandarek, who a fortnight ago defeated 3-time world champion Christian Coleman, the 2016 Olympic javelin champion Thomas Roller, Olympics hammer throw champion Wojnik Nowicki, and the 2022 World Hammer Throw champion Pavel Vajdek will also grace the event. Race director Barnabas Correa described Kipkino Classic as one of the best organized meets on the continent and indeed the rest of the world.
Kipkino Classic started 5 years ago and it has been growing in pounds and leaps and pounds. It's one of the best organized meets in the world now as a continental tour court, which is the only one in Africa at the moment.
Staying with athletics, track and field athletes will be the first batch of Olympians to receive prize money for winning gold, ending a 128-year tradition. This comes after World Athletics announced a cash prize of $50,000 for every gold medal won in the track and field events. The reward will start at this year's Olympics in Paris. Additionally, there will be prize rewards for silver and bronze medalists in Los Angeles 2028. Paul Okello, the organizing secretary of the Uganda Athletics Federation, believes this is great motivation for athletes as the federation has already qualified 15 athletes for the games.
Every athlete wants to be at the Olympics. So with the new, the big announcement that came from World Athletics of rewarding the gold medal, it's $50,000. It's another boost.
In swimming news, South Africa's best swimmers are vying for places on Team South Africa for the Paris Olympics at the South Africa Swimming Championships, which began on Monday and is expected to be concluded on Saturday. It's a tougher task this time around since the IOC revised the qualifying standards. The committee is expecting to welcome 700 swimmers to Paris this year instead of the usual 1,000. Amy Carney, 100 meters freestyle champion for women, and Peter Kudzi, the 100 meters freestyle champion, both agreed that South African swimmers are embracing the new standards introduced to this year's Olympic Games by the IOC.
The whole world's swimming faster, so we just have to swim faster, I guess.
I think it's good. I think the sport's growing around the world. People are becoming faster.
And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, April 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Botting, Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba ba ba.